When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, Shay here. I just want to take a second to say something about the episode you're about to hear. This isn't something we typically do on the show, but during this episode, we're going to discuss some very graphic details of a particularly violent crime. I wanted to take this chance to ensure our listeners that we don't do this lightly, and there is a reason I go into such detail. I also wanted to make it apparent that this is not something that we are doing for shock value, but rather to give a very clear and complete picture of the case, the circumstances, and the overall repercussions. This content may not be suitable for all listeners, and listener discretion is strongly advised. Thank you, and enjoy the episode.
Welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay.
And today, we're going to finally hear the story that Shay has been touting and teasing and talking about since literally before this podcast even began.
Oh my gosh.
I'm very excited to get into that. But first, we wanted to comment upon the news of the capture of the suspect in the Golden State Killer.
Yes. Oh my gosh, what news?
We're a little bit late on this since this happened basically a week ago or so. We kind of quibbled about whether or not we wanted to broach the subject at all. But you know what? This arrest is the biggest news in true crime since the capture of Dennis Rader as BTK. And as a true crime podcast, I would feel negligent personally to not comment upon it.
Yeah, we got to, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a little thing written up here that I kind of want to talk about. But if you're tired of the Golden State Killer news and the conversations going on right now in true crime, I don't know you. I don't know who you are, because I could literally talk and listen to it all day. Mm-hmm. But go ahead and skip about 5 minutes so you can get it right into the case. But I did want to talk about this because it's just so exciting. It's such a relief. It's such a beautiful and brilliant thing to have happened to us. The Golden State Killer.
Yeah.
This is a serial rapist and a serial killer who for over 40 years has terrified people all around the world. I remember about a year or two ago when Case File had its series on this guy. We were hanging out with our friends, and our friend Kelly and I were sort of regaling you guys. I don't know if you remember this, Shay.
Oh, I remember.
We were regaling you guys about a lot of the details about this case. And one of the things that I remember us talking about was Kelly, our friend, was talking about the case to her husband, Jason, who isn't a true crime fan or anything. But she was telling him some of the details, and it freaked him out to the point where he literally got up and went to check on his guns and ammunition.
Yeah,
to make sure everything was in proper order, because the story was that scary.
And it's chilling.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think holds true for most people is that the Iran's crimes are the stuff of horror movies. Him scoping people out, breaking into people's houses, moving their things around, unloading their guns, and even coming back then to rape, torture, and murder. He was and is the worst of the worst. And his crimes, even today, when you hear about them, cause so much dread and fear that he became kind of a legend. And we've talked about this phenomenon on this show before, serial killers becoming storybook figures or movie monsters and almost becoming unreal. And this was absolutely the case with this Golden State Killer, especially because he hurt so many people for so long and it seemed like he was never going to get caught. But not anymore. Now that we have this suspect, this alleged suspect.
That's right.
What's so exciting about the rest of this suspect is, to paraphrase Michelle McNamara, he's now stepped into the light, and now we're going to be able to see the chinks and the cracks in his armor, and we're going to see that he's not a storybook monster, but he's just like every other sexually sadistic serial killer that's ever lived. He was a broken, pathetic coward whose only validation and sense of power came from hurting people, especially women. And I love that in real time, we're all going to be collectively breaking that mythology together. And this is so important, not just for the 12 or more people he murdered, not just for the 50 or more women he brutalized and raped, not just for the family members and friends, but the entire state of California and beyond, even back to people like you and me who read about him or listened to him on a podcast and even today suddenly felt unsafe in their own homes. And just like everyone else, I'd like to really commend Michelle McNamara on her work on keeping this case in the public eye. As Patton Oswalt said recently, no one may officially be recognizing her work as being a part of the story, but every time he's referred to as the Golden State Killer, the moniker she came up with, then they're crediting Michelle McNamara and her work. And so much love and appreciation go out to the men and women on the streets, all the cops and FBI agents, and whoever who worked to finally close this thing. And it just gives me so much hope because it was also the dogged, tireless efforts of McNamara and everyone she worked with, including so many victims who have bravely come forward to tell their stories, so many writers and even podcasters. They all kept this story alive to make sure that it didn't go away and kept the pressure up to all of the authorities involved to solve this case. And I think that really goes to show that victims, survivors, family, friends, et cetera, can have a voice and can be loud and public and angry and willful and can make a difference with getting their cases solved and getting justice. It's just a beautiful thing. I'm so happy right now. And a little bit of an update that this just dropped recently, but Criminology Podcast, their second season was on the Eron's case. Absolutely recommend go listen to that if you want more information. Very great. And they were actually the first ones to kind of really drop this bombshell about the arrest on the Eron's case on social media. Well, they just tweeted a news story from the Sacramento Bee saying that Vallejo police have now sent this Zodiac Killer's DNA to a crime lab, and they're hoping to do the same thing that they just did with the Golden State Killer case. They're going to be taking his DNA and hoping to maybe find these public genealogy records or whatever to try to find who he is. So this is excellent for true crime. We're hopefully going to get even more cases resolved this way. It's the most exciting thing, like I said, that's happened for decades in true crime, and it just brings me a lot of hope personally.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a whole new world in true crime. It opens up a lot of doors and possibilities that we never thought were possible. And, you know, it's cool that we live in a time and an era where these things are happening and we can all be a part of it as a true crime community.
Yeah, absolutely. And how much safer do you feel?
Yeah, I feel a lot
better. Honestly, it sounds silly, but I feel safer knowing that he is behind bars and will hopefully never draw another breath as a free man. It makes me so happy.
Plus what it means for moving forward for any other piece of absolute crap that tries to pull anything similar. We're going to find you. We're going to get you. This whole true crime community, we're going to band together. And we're going
to And that's the most important thing, is not only solving past crimes, but making sure future crimes are way more difficult to get away with and that happen less frequently. That's the most important thing in true crime. And so that's what we're seeing. And it's just, it's really exciting all around. It's just, it's going to be great to see what the future holds for cases like this.
Yeah. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for putting that little bit together.
Hell yes. I've been so excited the past, you know, when I first saw the news, I freaked out because I saw the news literally as it dropped on social media. It was like 2 a.m. because we don't sleep, you and I. And I remember I turned to you and I was like, I'm seeing this, but I can't confirm it. I only see one news source that's saying anything about this. So I went ahead and retweeted it and mm-hmm. posted it, you know, on our Facebook page and other places. And I was like, I'm not sure, yeah. but I'm excited.
We all went to bed late, late in the night wondering. And then yeah. we woke up in the morning.
And it had broken wide yeah. open. And we already had, I mean, we had the name, we had the profession, we had yeah. everything so early on before that press conference even occurred. We had so much details and information. And that's, I mean, you know, all the people of Reddit and all of those just like armchair investigators who got this information, man, glory be to them, because that was fantastic.
Yeah, they did a great job. I mean, his booking number was out immediately and they broke the sheriff's office server looking up his booking number yeah. to see like what stage of the booking he was in.
And it's so wonderful. Literally, I could record an entire episode on this, but it's just been so interesting to see the pieces fall into place. Where it's like, oh, this happened. And, you know, it's just little things like he, you know, of course, this is an alleged suspect in the case. But like his anniversary, he killed like for 3 years in a row on his marriage anniversary. He was engaged to a woman named Bonnie, who it's believed that he was saying perhaps the name Bonnie during some of his attacks. Yeah. I mean, all of this stuff, it's been so crazy to learn these details. I mean,
we finally got answers about how he got around dogs too.
Yeah.
He bought dog repellent.
Absolutely.
And was caught shoplifting that.
And who
all
knows,
kinds of stuff.
Because he was a police officer during a great deal, a great time span during his crime spree. How well did that help him? You know, was he yeah. flashing his badge around when he was at crime scenes? And, yeah.
and he was also yeah. caught with DNA on DNA Day.
Yes. On International DNA Day. Ha! Science.
Yeah.
Thank you, science.
And you know,
so fantastic.
We love science. Well, are you ready to get into this next Lone Star Lunatic series?
I feel like I need to settle and take some deep breaths. All of us right now, let's just go ahead and take some deep breaths. Let's do a little yoga. Stretch yourself out. If you're at your office, at work, you know, just stand up. Untense your shoulders. You know, crack your neck, because this case is going to be something that's going to make you so angry.
Yeah, this episode is going to get intense. So be warned, there's some really graphic details. Besides that, on top of it, the case is damn near bonkers. So I'm glad that we started with a nice, simple prison escape to talk about the Texas penal system, because now we're going to go on the flip side of that coin. So with no further ado, I bring you episode 19, The Broomstick Killer. My sources for this episode include The Bad Boy from Rosebud by Gary M. Laverne. And if you want to know anything else about The Broomstick Killer, I highly recommend this book. It's my primary source for a reason. This book and Gary goes into so much depth that you could ever imagine. I've highly recommended it to you that after we do this episode, you read it. It's really great. It's years and years, decades of research that have gone into this book. It's awesome. I can't say enough about it. The book Crime in Texas, which is your complete guide to the criminal justice system. This was written by Ken Anderson. If you want to know anything about what we've been talking about the last couple of Lone Star Lunatics episodes, this book describes why Texas was really messed up from the 1960s to the 2000s.
I was about to say, until present day.
We're still recovering from a terrible time in the judicial system here in Texas. And this book talks about all of it. And it's a really good read. It's a little heady. It gets into some legal jargon, but there's some really nice sections in between that help you understand what's going on during the time periods. And Kenneth Alan McDuff, the Broomstick Killer, is a big part of this book. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram articles from August to November of 1966 play a big role in this case. We actually got to do a cool thing where we went to the library and dug through microfilm, which I thought was awesome. It made me feel like a real investigator. It made me feel like I was part of the FBI and I was like going back through old cases, you know, and you get to do the thing where you put the film on like the spindle and you turn it and it's like whoosh, and it's going back and forth, you know?
Man. And then we found what we were looking for.
Oh my
we're
God.
Like, yay!
Yeah, it was so cool. Yeah. If you haven't gone and played with microfilm, find a case. Go find the date and go do it. It's fun. You feel legit. Also, I want to do a big shout out to another Gary, Gary Cartwright. We've talked about him before in one of the other cases. He's a writer for Texas Monthly. He did a really awesome article called Free to Kill, and that was put out in 1992, kind of in the middle of this case, like during one of the major developments in this case. But it's a really good read for the first section of The Broomstick Killer. I also checked out two documentaries. One of them was Crime and Punishment, Free to Murder Again. That was on the ID channel. And then I also did the Dateline episode, Kenneth Alan McDuff, The Broomstick Murderer. He goes by both. It's Broomstick Killer, Broomstick Murderer, Bad Boy from Rosebud, all AKAs. So yeah, those are my sources. Now, let's set the scene. So you might be asking yourselves, what are we doing discussing Kenneth Alan McDuff? What does this have to do with the last series, Shay? Well, I promised you that we would revisit the Texas penal system and that it would take you back to the beginning. Hopefully this episode will give you a little better understanding of what led to the situation which Erin discussed in her case, The Texas Seven. Well, this is it. If you haven't listened to that series yet, stop what you're doing, go back, listen to Erin's two episodes on The Texas Seven. So when we left off, Erin described a scene of a Texas justice system that was overreacting to crime. They were dishing out hard sentences and lengthy terms as a way to be tough on crime. The third largest prison system in the world was in full form as they packed all of their brand new cells full of fresh new prisoners and understaffed their facilities and privatized everything they could under the sun. What we're talking about are the results of an overcorrection. So it's kind of like when you make a mistake on an icy road and you start to lose control a little bit and spin out, and then you kind of freak out and white knuckle the wheel a little bit and you turn the wheel way too far and it just sends your car into a tailspin. That's Kenneth Alan McDuff. That's what we're about to talk about. He would come to represent every wrong move, bad decision, and produce a cascade of decisions that led all the way back to the federal courts and both houses of the United States Congress. There is something timeless about the man that I'm about to describe to you. Since his early childhood, many have known something constant about him, his cold-blooded and dangerous nature. Even still, Kenneth Alan McDuff was able to find a way to terrify the Texas public for 27 long years, all the while authorities, teachers, neighbors, legal experts, mental health professionals, and everyday residents of the state of Texas have been raising red flags and screaming to the hills, "This man is a bad seed. Lock him up." Join me as we take you through the story, the life, the crimes, the victims, and the eventual repercussions of the notorious broomstick killer, Texas's one and only, Kenneth Alan McDuff. All right, let's go back to a little tiny town in Texas called Rosebud. This is where our story starts. It's nestled within the Blackland Prairie of Texas. This is an area characterized by rolling hills, temperate savannas, vegetation, and we're talking about some of Texas's prime farmland. The soil of the Black Prairies, from which the Blackland gets its name, it contains black and deep dark gray alkaline clays, which is further blackened by char from wildfires and controlled burns. The area is known as, quote, black gumbo or black velvet. This is some of the names that the locals refer to the soil and the resulting look of the land. I think it's fitting that some jerk, some piece of crap like Kenneth Alan McDuff comes from an area called the Blackland. The old town motto was Rosebud, we call it home. The community named it such during an agricultural boom of the post-World War II era.
We call it home?
Yeah.
Okay. They could have worked on that for a minute longer.
I know. It's really haphazardly thrown together. Oh, we farm really well. Everything's going good. We got tons of corn. We call it home. In an article by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Rosebud is currently described as a bedroom community. This is sort of a community of commuters heading off to Temple, Waco, and Marlin, Texas to do their working. Yeah, it's very similar to a lot of other small towns in Texas that aren't necessarily suburbs. They're just tiny little towns that just people live at and they drive to a bigger town to do their work. The McDuff family originally moved to the area from none other than Paris, Texas, Aaron.
Oh, we have lots of friends from Paris, Texas. Yeah.
What is it? The biggest little Eiffel Tower in Texas?
Some crap like that, yeah.
Yeah. It has a cowboy hat on top.
It does.
They do have a real legitimate Eiffel Tower in town. And
yep. All of our friends are like, you have to do it, a case from Paris, Texas, just so you can talk about the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah. His genes originated from there, I guess you can say that. So he's the progeny from people that come from Paris, Texas. Yeah. Well, it's not really clear why they originally moved from Paris, but a lot of people think it's because his father, who was known as J.A., he was a farmer and he was good at farm work. And this area was in a big agricultural boom, so he moved to the area to try and do some farm work. That's what most people think. His mother, Adie McDuff, moved with the family, but she was not the farm worker per se. She was much more like a entrepreneur of her own right. She always wanted to have her things, her business, and have her money. So when Adie settled with J.A. in Rosebud, she quickly opened a laundromat right on Main Street, and it was the only laundromat in town. This gave her kind of a monopoly of the area. And pretty much everyone in town who needed to go to a laundromat came to her place. Well, originally, the family lived in back of the laundromat, and it was not the greatest of homes. It was pretty run down, depressing, and kind of dingy from reports of people who went in there and visited. So J.A. and Adie McDuff, they moved to the area. They had some skills, but they were aspiring for more. They were searching for more in their lives. Now, J.A.'s real name is John Allen. Not only was he good at farm work, he was also good at concrete, and he had done some work in the concrete business. Well, he starts his own concrete company and on the side of doing farm work. Mostly, to everyone in town, he was known as a workaholic. He had multiple jobs, he was hardly ever at home, he didn't have a lot to say, he just loved to work, he was a hard worker. He wanted to provide for his family and give his kids something more that he didn't have. Adie is the one who ran the household. She's the captain of the ship. She ran the McDuffs with an iron fist. It's said that she not only ran every aspect of their family life, but she also held sway over the finances, life decisions, and also over general community politics. She was a mover and shaker in community groups and church groups. So you want a fun fact about his mom, Adie?
Sure.
She was known as the pistol packing mama because she carried a gun no matter where she went. It was always loaded and in her purse. And she was not shy about threatening people with said pistol. If she didn't get her way, she'd made it known that she was armed and ready for combat, basically.
Huh.
Now, I have to point out that Adie does reject this nickname and claims that she never carried a pistol in her purse. However, the amount of reports and admissions that, yes, she did brandish a pistol at certain events around town and in certain scenarios are just so many. Like, there's a whole chapter dedicated to the pistol packing mama in Gary Laverne's book. It's kind of fun. Several Rosebud residents had their share of rumors and tales about Adie getting her way by brandishing her pistol, but it looks like the rumors started from school teachers who referred to Adie in this way. It was due to an incident where she pulled this infamous pistol out when she was threatening a bus driver by stating there had better not be any more disturbances involving her children on his bus.
Wait, what? Her children were causing problems?
Yeah.
She was
a pistol packing mama.
She was threatening the bus driver about it.
Yeah, she brandished her pistol at a school bus driver because her turd kids were starting crap on the bus. Yeah, and she didn't want to hear any more stories about it. He better take care of it, or she was going to take care of him, basically, is what she's saying. When Adie McDuff, the matriarch, wasn't wielding her iron fist, or she wasn't taking up for her boys that could do no wrong in her eyes, she would just be making sure business was as usual in her fancy laundromat. I should also point out here that neither J.A. or Adie had so much as a parking ticket on their criminal record. So they were very law-abiding citizens, even though they were known to threaten people with firearms around town, apparently. So you, on the one hand, you got J.A. with his concrete business. You got 80 with her laundromat monopoly. Both of the McDuff businesses began to prosper soon. A little bit after that, they moved out of the small little space behind the Rosebud laundromat into a nice two-story home on Linden Street, which was a very nice, calm street in Rosebud. Kenneth L. McDuff was born in this house on March 21st of 1946. He was the fifth of six children to J.A. and 80, and it was said he was not particularly bright.
I believe it.
Yeah. No one suspected any mental disability like they did with his older brother, who was known around town as Rough Tough Lonnie McDuff, but rather that Kenneth was just a dull child. Yeah. He was large for his age, and he quickly figured out that he could bully smaller children among his own age group and at school. Kenneth did have an aptitude for making money, however. As a young child, he had his own lawn mowing service. He claimed that he had more money than most adult Rosebud residents due to his hard-working ethics. However, this did not stop him from stealing money from sweet little old ladies at the laundromat in his spare time. Maybe snag a little purse, take out the pocketbook, place the purse back. If any customer got angry and was like, "Where's my money, 80? She'd brandish her pistol and be like, "My boys do no wrong," and run him out of the laundromat.
Oh my God.
Those are stories that literally happened.
Wow. So mom was very much an enabler, it sounds
Oh, yeah. She was very protective.
And dad was too busy working to really probably discipline his sons.
I mean, he was pretty much an enabler of his wife to enable the boys.
Okay.
Yeah. Whatever 80 said, he would stand by it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get into more of their descriptions later with this fun thing that I have for you here in a minute. This little stealing that starts out when he's a young kid running his own lawn mowing service. It was what Kenneth would call to do things for the thrill, the rush of it. Because he could. And this comes out of interviews that we have from Kenneth by Gary Laverne. With an IQ estimated to be around 92, which, if you don't know, that's barely within the average range, he often found things funny that others didn't. He relished failure, strange things, and classmates often recall his strange, menacing laughter coming out of nowhere at strange times.
Oh, Jesus. He sounds like, what's the bad guy from the Back to the Future movies? The big...
Biff.
He sounds Biff like Tannen. Biff. Yeah, like just a big, mean idiot.
Yeah, big dolt that has like followers just because they're scared of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll keep that image in your head.
Okay.
Kenneth's disciplinary problems really didn't begin to arise until he made his way to middle school and high school. Most people just put up with him as like adult, you know, and kind of a dullard who was just too big until he got to middle school and high school, where his problems started to become a little more serious. So in his prison records, we later find in the file this following statement that was written down voluntarily by his principal from his high school, D.L. Mayo, a World War II veteran who was the principal of his school, who was known as a complete hard ass and an awesome dude. So the letter reads, "Did not get along with students, teachers, or anyone. He would lie, steal, and destroy the property of others. Was in some form of trouble every few days. He had trouble in the community from reckless driving and stealing. His family would seldom believe he had done anything wrong and were always angry with school officials and local police for punishing him. His family is very unpopular within the community. This young man has been angry with the world ever since the fourth and fifth grade. His mother was neurotic and is unreasonable. His father is not neurotic, but often unreasonable. However, the boy's mother and father did work to provide him with the necessities. Kenneth had the ordinary comforts as much as the average boy of this community."
Wow.
What a statement from your principal, right?
Wow. Talk about like a psychological evaluation from the principal of your elementary school.
Well,
or is that high school?
High school. And apparently at one point, Kenneth didn't like how he was being talked to by the principal, who again is a World War II veteran. Pulled a knife on him, whereas the principal grabbed him by the throat took the knife away and threw Kenneth down a flight of stairs.
Oh, man. What a tragedy that he just didn't break his neck right there, huh? Yeah. Would have saved all of us a lot of trouble.
I just love that imagery of like this hardened World War II veteran just lifting him up like the Undertaker in WWE and just tossing him down a flight of stairs.
Oh, my Lord.
Like, I had enough of your guff. Wah! No, if you hear Kenneth tell that story, he beat up the principal.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure.
Well, Kenneth ended up maturing, unfortunately, and he grew to be 6'4", 250 pounds of lean, angry fury. He was known to wear leather, he slicked back his hair with grease, and he took pleasure in roughing up boys. His angry and vulnerable nature scared most of his fellow students and many of the adults of Rosebud. He took to riding a loud motorcycle and carrying a gun to shoot stuff around town, i.e. mailboxes, signs, animals, etc. So the residents learned to fear the sound of Macduff's ride and knew that something would be found with bullet holes after it went by. His reign of terror over Rosebud High School would come to an end thanks to one Tommy Sammons. A popular athletic boy, Tommy was shorter than Kenneth by far, but when bullied by him, he didn't back down like the other kids at school. He actually stood up. So Kenneth tried to bully Tommy one day, and he called him a chicken shit. To which Tommy agreed, I'll fight you anywhere. You name the place. So Kenneth said, how about in the ravine after school under the bridge? Which is crazy, right? That just outside the school, there's a bridge with a ravine where people go to fight and like settle differences. This is like some freaking greaser movie, right? Like someone's going to end up jumping a motorcycle
it
in the ravine.
Sounds like Stephen King's It.
It does. That's exactly what happened. After school, at said time, Tommy and Kenneth...
Oh, come on, Sammons.
Yeah, yeah.
F him up, yeah. Sammons.
They show up at the ravine, and of course, you know, all the kids in school show up because Kenneth has been bullying them since they were in grade school. And they're all rooting for Tommy.
Yeah.
They're just so excited for Tommy to kick that ass. Well, the fight starts, and Kenneth comes in with a lot of fury. He comes in fast. He comes in hard, but he's not particularly quick or athletic. He's just a big dullard, right? Tommy is athletic. He's in sports. He knows how to bob, weave, dodge. He's agile. And he tires Kenneth out and then gets him in a headlock and just starts beating the crap out of him over and over. And one kid said that he whipped the snot out of him. He ran home and told everybody around his home, like in his neighborhood, that Kenneth L. Macduff had the snot whipped out of him by Tommy Sammons. So anyways, after this happens, and like, you know, the whole school is super happy that Kenneth Allen Macduff got the crap
beat
out of him.
Even the teachers, that principal was probably in the background, but like, hey. Yeah.
He's like handing out snacks. Shortly after that, Kenneth quit school. And he began working for his father pouring concrete because, you know, his invincible aura had dissipated. And it left him with even more anger and fury that he couldn't unleash on the high school. Yeah, so during the day, he's working with his dad, J.A., at the concrete business. He also did some work as a farmhand. But most of the time, he was either pouring concrete or he was doing his own activities, which entailed racing motorcycles and fast cars, acts of terrible vandalism, and drinking heavily by the age of 15. Notably, his favorite drink was White Lightning.
Ew, what is that?
That is moonshine.
Okay.
Yeah, that was his favorite thing to do. And in the spring of 1964, Kenneth began committing a string of burglaries with some of the other boys in town. These burglaries spanned several cities and towns nearby. But on March 10th in 1965, Kenneth Allen Macduff was sentenced to 52 years in prison for 14 counts of burglary. However, it was deemed that these sentences would run concurrently, and that means 4 years for each of the offenses. So really, the sentences only turned out to be 4 years in total. In these burglaries, he and his friends would go in and rob people's vaults, steal people's boats, cars, ransack their houses, that kind of thing.
So it was basically 4 years for how many robberies again?
14 counts of burglary.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
It should have been 52 years, but, you know, we're talking about the 1960s. Uh-huh. So, again, there's not a lot of room in the prisons in Texas. So the judge decided to have them run concurrently to allow him a chance at parole and to have a life. He kind of showed mercy on Kenneth.
Oh, thanks, Judge.
Yeah.
I'm sure that won't, you know, be a mistake in the future.
Mm. On December 9th, 1965, after serving 9 months and 2 weeks in prison, Kenneth Al McDuff would be paroled for the first time in his lengthy criminal career. So this is number one. This is parole number one.
Okay.
Gary LeVert. Well, did you want to say anything? That sounded
no,
like
it's
you
just
didn't care.
14 cases of burglary. 4 years paroled in 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to get those numbers straight.
Yeah, and that kind of gives you an idea of this quick parole process that we're going to get into later down the road at the end of this episode. Gary LeVern interviewed Kenneth Al McDuff later on, and when asked about these offenses, Kenneth referred to these burglaries as, quote, just pranks.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, too, though, because this is how a lot of serial killers get their start. It's the whole invasion of privacy. It's breaking into somebody's personal space. They like that power. It's really interesting how so many serial killers get their start on serial burglary.
Yep. And you're also seeing the first instance of Kenneth having a crew of fellow kids his own age who are also kind of maligned from society. They're all kind of greasers. They all ride motorcycles and
they're
fast
all
cars.
Throwaway kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, he comes from money and he has power. He's big. You know, he's got a nice motorcycle, a nice car. His dad owns land and a company. So, like, he's their leader, mm-hmm. you know. Let's move just a little bit forward in time. Let's go to August 6th, 1966. So at this point, 20-year-old Kenneth Al McDuff and an 18-year-old friend named Roy Dale Green are headed to Fort Worth, Texas for a night on the town. Earlier that day, they had helped to pour concrete at a construction site in Temple, Texas. They rushed back to Rosebud and decided to wash up for Roy Dale Green's first big visit to Fort Worth. Kenneth told...
What, are they going to go to a honky-tonk? Well, they're going to go down to the stockyards? What are they going to do in Fort Worth?
Roy Dale Green was like looking for something like that. Like, Kenneth had told him that he was going to show him the town and some real fun. If you remember, and this is from one of our other episodes, what year did I say it was? 1966. And what also happened 5 days earlier in the month of August in 1966? One of the hottest years on record.
Oh, it Charles Whitman and the UT Tower shooting.
That is correct.
So this is 5 days after the tower shooting.
5 days after the tower shooting.
Wow, okay.
Keep that in mind. So it's a really hot, humid, miserable summer. The tower shootings just happened. We're not even a week removed from that happening down in Austin. Now, Roy Dale Green, he's described as being a weak-willed type, a dull kind of follower of sorts. And Kenneth Al McDuff was the perfect guy to help him, quote, run with the big boys, ride in fancy cars, show him how to get the ladies. He's just turned 18. He doesn't have a lot of friends. You know, he's never really been on a big date. He's never had a successful girlfriend. It's said by friends that he looked up to Kenneth. Roy Dale Green worked at the family concrete business along with Kenneth Al McDuff and AJA, and the men struck up a relationship there, and, you know, Kenneth bragged a lot. He'd give him some beer from time to time, and he would talk about his exploits with other women and stuff like that. So Roy in his mind is thinking, we're going to go to Fort Worth and Kenneth is going to like show me a party. You know, like, I've never been to the big city before. Maybe we'll go, like he said, maybe we'll go to a saloon, a honky tonk. Maybe we'll hit up some Cowtown. You know, maybe even a rodeo's in the options for Roy. Who knows? Well, the men begin their drive to Fort Worth by going ahead and buying a couple of six-packs of Schlitz. And just downing those on the...
Schlitz?
Yep.
Now, they are not good old Texas boys if they're drinking Schlitz. You gotta get some Lone Star up in there.
They didn't have Lone Star back then.
Did they not?
Now, this is the 60s. Schlitz is pretty big back then.
What about Shiner? Shiner's been around.
No, Shiner hadn't been around that long.
Really?
Nope.
So all you got for cheap beer is Schlitz, huh?
Yeah.
What a bummer.
Yeah, well, they're loaded up on Schlitz. They're throwing them back. They're having what I used to call back in the day a road soda. They killed off those 2 6-packs on the way to Fort Worth.
Killed off some brain cells, too, sounds like.
Yeah. Much like we're doing right now. Cheers. And
I was about to say, Kenneth Atwell McDuff doesn't sound like he has too many brain cells to spare.
Yeah, not with that IQ. The first place they stopped off was a local bar known as Helen's Bar. And this is a place that Kenneth had been before, and they ended up meeting with an old friend that Kenneth knew. The more they drank, Kenneth began to speak on his plans for the remainder of the evening. He wanted to pick up girls, do some violence, and even joked about rape. I want to make a pause in the story and say, this is where the hijinks is really over. The story is going to get really serious and we're going to stop messing around from here on forward. Maybe there'll be some room for that at the end of the episode, but we're not going to make fun of any of the events that happen from here on out. I'm just telling you, the story takes a turn here.
I know. I'm not excited about it. I'm very worried.
Yeah. This is something that we now believe Kenneth Alan McDuff had plans for weeks. Mm-hmm. And he actually invited several of his other close friends within his group of contemporaries for this particular trip. All of them declined. Roy Dale Green was the unfortunate lackey that ended up signing up for this roller coaster ride we're about to go on. So either Roy Dale Green was too stupid or didn't take it seriously enough, or he was just too enamored with Kenneth in general to know what he was doing and what was going to happen. He would later tell authorities that Kenneth liked to put on a show by being loud and proud, is what he said. Roy Dale Green would later testify that Kenneth Alan McDuff would often speak of doing such things, but that he had never believed him until that very night. Once, Kenneth Alan McDuff had told him, killing a woman is like killing a chicken. They both squawk.
Guys, if you have a friend who says anything even close to that, make them not your friend any longer. True. Very problematic True. Words.
Yeah. It's not, they're not worth your time.
No.
And you don't want to end up like Roy Dale Green, let me tell you that. He also asked Kenneth Alan McDuff if he'd ever killed someone before. To that, Kenneth replied, he had killed and buried several women's bodies in shallow graves. That's where they belonged. So after further drinking, and apparently a short date with the friend's sister that they met at Helen's Bar, who happened to live in the Forest Hill, Everman area, they found themselves in the neighborhood and streets of Everman, Texas. Yeah, apparently they went on a date with this girl. Roy Dale Green just kind of drove them around while they kissed in the back, and then they went on a short walk, and then they dropped her off at her house, and then they decided to drive around some streets in Everman. And Kenneth Alan McDuff, according to Robert Dale Green's testimony, was very clear about what he was going to do. He was hunting for some women to prey upon. He said, let's go find some chicks, someone we can get in the car and do what we want. I know exactly where to find them. I'm going to stop here for a second and say, this is my hometown. I am from this town. And I had no idea that this was part of this story until I started doing the research. And it blew my mind that this is where this happened, and it shocked me to the core. And in fact, I know a lot of the places that we're about to talk about, and it's scary. I'm never going to go back home to my hometown and drive by these places and look at them the same.
Yeah.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
So yeah, it's around 9 o'clock at night. They're driving around town. They decide to head over to Everman High School. And there's a baseball field that's nearby that I've actually played a couple of pickup games at. And they see a car parked over there near the baseball fields. Inside the car is 16-year-old Edna Louise Sullivan, her boyfriend, 17-year-old Robert Brand, and Robert's 15-year-old cousin, Marcus Dunham. They're inside a 1955 Ford, just kind of hanging out, joking, shooting the breeze. They just went to a movie, and they were most likely stargazing on a clear night. Edna, who actually went by her middle name, Louise, was an Everman High School student. She was about to begin her junior year that month. Remember, it's August. She was hopefully planning on continuing her varsity basketball experience that year. She was really good at basketball. She was notably short and undersized, but she was very good at basketball. And she also kept up really good grades, and she volunteered at a nursery at the local Baptist church just down the road. And a month earlier, she had started dating Robert. She met Robert at the church. Robert Brand was actually from Alvarado, Texas, just down the road. So yeah, Robert was good looking. He played in a local band down in Alvarado. By all claims, he was a really good kid. He loved music and loved playing guitar. His younger cousin, Marcus, who was in the car with them, was actually staying with the family for the summer. And the two were said to be more like brothers than they were actually cousins. Originally, the night had been planned as a double date night. That's why Marcus was in the car. Marcus, who also played music in bands, adored his cousin Robert, and Robert had agreed to hook him up with a friend so that they could have a double date and go to the movies. Well, the missing girl on the planned double date was Luis's friend, Rhonda. She had actually chickened out of the date, faked being ill, but was still planning on Louise coming over to her house to spend the night later that night. In fact, both of them lived just down the street from each other on Marlene Street in Everman, Texas. I know a bunch of friends that lived on that street, which is also crazy.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Kenneth Allen McDuff parked his Dodge Coronet about 150 yards away from their Ford. He pulled out a Colt Special revolver out of the console between him and Roy Dale Green, and he told Roy Dale to grab the stick in the back seat and to follow him. Roy Dale did as he was asked. Reportedly, Roy Dale stayed back about 75 yards and watched Kenneth Allen McDuff creep up on the unsuspecting teenagers in the vehicle. He advanced on the vehicle in time to hear Kenneth tell the trio, "Get out of the car or I will shoot you." Kenneth took the boys' wallets, instructed all three of them to get into the trunk of the Ford. He told Roy Dale to get in and drive them back to the Dodge. He also told Roy Dale, once they got back to the Dodge, to switch to that car, and Kenneth would drive the Ford while Roy Dale followed them behind in the Dodge. You have Kenneth driving the Ford with the three teenagers in the trunk. Roy Dale is in Kenneth's car, being the Dodge, following them. At this point, they began driving. They began driving down backcountry roads that I'm familiar with, and they went down likely US 81 to get to the Tarrant Johnson County line, which is actually near Burleson. They finally stopped along Farm Road 1017. And at this point, Kenneth stops the car. He gets out. He pulls Louise out of the trunk and places her in the trunk of his Dodge. He then told Roy Dale Green, "Those boys got to look at me. I'm going to have to kill them. We can't have any witnesses. I'm going to have to knock them off." Roy Dale stated that he tried to say, "You don't need to do that. That's why are we deciding to do that? Why are you going to do this?" But that before he knew it, Kenneth Allen McDuff was shooting. He also stated that the boys begged for their lives before the shooting began, but once the shooting started, he kind of blanked out and doesn't remember a whole lot of the details of the boys being shot. Kenneth shot Robert in the ear and also in the forehead. He then turned the gun on Marcus, his younger cousin, and the first shot hit the boy in the arm as he was trying to defend himself as best he could. Frustrated, Kenneth grabbed Marcus's hair, pulled his head back, placed the gun against the boy's head, and fired one last time. Kenneth placed the boys' bodies back inside the Ford's trunk, but he couldn't manage to get the trunk closed. Instead of rearranging the bodies so that he could get it shut, in frustration, Kenneth just backed the car up to a fence and left it open. They then left with Louise locked in the trunk of Kenneth Allen McDuff's Dodge. They traveled further south, deeper into Johnson County, to an area near the town of Eagan, Texas. They turned off on Farm Road 917 onto a gravel road, where they finally stopped in a farm cut, which is in the middle of a hayfield. Once more, Kenneth told Louise to get out of the trunk. This time, however, he ordered her into the back seat of the car. There, he made her remove her clothes, and he raped her. Reportedly, Roy stood back outside of the car and tried to not be part of the event. He admittedly said that he watched at some points in the darkness. Kenneth then asked Roy if he wanted to have a go with her. Roy said initially he did not and refused, but feared what Kenneth would do if he said no. After all, he still had the revolver. At this point, Roy Dale Green did not realize that the revolver had all the shells spent. Reportedly, it took Roy Dale Green some time to become aroused enough to complete the rape, but eventually he did. And after that, Kenneth returned to the back seat with Louise and raped her yet again.
Jesus.
But this time, it was with the sharp end of the broken broomstick that lay on the floorboard. This was the same stick that Roy had been ordered to hold earlier by Kenneth when approaching their vehicle. Roy recounted the scene later to investigators and spoke of horrible screams. He mostly remembered Louise yelling, quote, "Stop, I think you ripped something." Once Kenneth decided he was done, he ordered Louise to put her clothes back on. They drove down another set of quiet country roads, mostly made of white chip stone, in the darkness of an August Texas night. They did so for an unknown amount of time, according to Roy Dale Green, until they stopped once more, and Kenneth ordered Edna Louise Sullivan out of the car one last time. She sat on the side of the road, just in front of the car. Kenneth retrieved the broomstick, and in the blink of an eye, he charged the seated Louise. He got on top of her with his knees on her chest and began choking her by placing the broomstick across her throat. Roy Dale Green reportedly tried to make Kenneth stop, but Kenneth responded, "It has to be done. Get the hell off of me. It has to be done." Soon, Roy could hear the sounds of the last air escaping Louise, quote, "like a leaky balloon." And he even testified and said that at the end, he heard the bones in Louise's neck break under Kenneth's weight, and after that, he knew she was dead. Once Kenneth himself was convinced that Louise had passed, he made Roy help him haul her body over a barbed wire fence through a field to where they laid her under a stand of oak trees amongst the underbrush. As Gary Laverne puts it in his book, this is where they finally left her alone. But yeah, man, it's a brutal, brutal depiction of what happened. And I think, like I was telling you a little bit about before we did this episode, it's almost like a survivor's story where there's a witness that can recount all the horrible details.
Yeah,
of the
but
crime.
A witness who was totally privy and engaged in what happened.
Oh, yeah. Whether he was forced to or whatever, if any of that's true, he's still guilty of what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's just to have Roy Dale recount the scene the way he does.
Yeah, because nobody else survived. So exactly. He's the only witness that we have, even though he was completely complicit. I don't care. No, I'm sorry. You don't get to say I was scared for my life, too. So I just totally went along with these things. And allowed three children to get murdered and one girl to be raped and murdered, who I raped myself as well. No, you don't get to say that.
No, we'll see here in a minute how the jury takes his statements.
And Louise was the girl that we saw on the microfilm, right? The girl with her little bob haircut, little 16-year-old.
Yeah, she was gorgeous. I mean, all the kids were. Yeah, they were beautiful, perfect kids that didn't deserve this.
They're little tiny babies. I've seen the pictures.
Yeah. Dude, when I was writing this, it was so hard to just like type those sentences out. It was rough. Like, I had to take several breaks, and then after I finally got it out, I just had to go and step away from it for a while, because it's a rough description. And, you know, if you've hung in there this long, the one good thing I can say about the rest of this story and the next part is that there's not a lot of graphic descriptions like this. So there's a lot of horrible things that happen, but the descriptions aren't this brutal.
Yeah.
So like I said, I'm bringing up these brutal details of this crime for a specific reason. I'm not doing it for shock value or to pull a particular reaction out of the listener. It's going to come up again down the road as a giant red flag to the story and a clear demarcation of like why this guy should never be given any leniency or shown any mercy whatsoever. We focus on the victims and we try and pay special care to the way that we treat victims. And in this particular case, it's important to the context of the story.
So after Kenneth and Roy Dale leave the scene of the crime, they head back south towards Rosebud. The following day, Robert and Marcus's bodies were found. They were found in the trunk of their Ford, which had been left by the roadside backed up to a fence. Some passersby saw the vehicle, went and inspected it, and discovered their bodies. When investigators first found the vehicle, they saw where either Marcus or Robert had used some of Louise's makeup to write her name on the back window from the inside in big letters. So apparently earlier when they were stargazing, one of them had used some of Louise's makeup while they were hanging out to write her name in the window. It just ended up surviving all the way to the crime scene, and it was like an eerie thing that investigators found, but was later turned out to not really be anything. In the following few days, everyone starts looking for Louise's body, and they're having a real tough time locating where Louise is. They know she's missing, and thousands of people actually volunteered and started searching all over Tarrant and Johnson County, even to the south near Alvarado. They didn't find much, though. The main break in the case actually came when Roy Dale Green started reading some of the articles that were coming out from publications like the Fort Worth Star-Telegram about the case. He broke down and he was overcome with grief and remorse, and he ended up telling a friend. This particular friend actually went to the authorities and told the authorities they thought Roy Dale Green knew something about the case and was involved. Roy Dale Green is picked up by authorities with really not much noise, and he goes willingly. When he first starts being interviewed by police, police are immediately struck by, again, how dull, how meek, how easy that he is to be intimidated, you know, and they're trying to hit him with hard questions. And he's telling them everything about the crime, but he doesn't seem to remember where Louise's body is. In fact, he rides around with investigators all over Tarrant and Johnson County, and he just can't remember which roads they took in the dark. Again, a lot of these are like gravel roads, farm roads, you know, they don't have street signs, stuff like that. They're out in the middle of nowhere. There's not lights.
And he's not from this area.
He's trying to help remember exactly where they went. And a couple of times they think they have the spot and it's just not the right spot. It's not until the investigators tell him to think through exactly what happened, and as he tells them what they did, to draw a loose map on a napkin. And after he does this, they completely change the area that they're searching for Louise, and they actually do find the area, and Roy Dale Green tells them to stop. I think this is it. He himself runs and jumps the barbed wire fence just down a ways a bit in a stand of oak trees and some underbrush. They find her body. So her body is actually discovered a couple of weeks later. So while this is going on, meanwhile, a separate manhunt is underway for Kenneth Allen McDuff, because Green tells investigators that he's the man that they're looking for and that he's the one mainly responsible for these crimes, even though Green was an accomplice to these crimes.
He's even able to give the police a tip where Kenneth Allen McDuff could be possibly found that night because he knew that he had a date with a girl from Bremen named Joanne. They were known to be in the Rosebud area that evening, and so investigators spread out all over Rosebud looking for places where young couples would hang out. They didn't have a whole lot of luck, though. But luckily, two sheriffs happened to go to Joanne's mother's home in Bremen, where Joanne was staying. They spoke with her mother, and they received permission to wait for the two in the bushes out in front of their home just in case they decided to come back. It's a good thing they did, because the two actually did return around 10:30 p.m. that evening. The only problem was is that Kenneth Allen McDuff's headlights of his Dodge shone onto the bushes and illuminated the police waiting in the bushes. And so as soon as he sees these two sheriffs, he throws the car into reverse and tries to take off. Well, this is where things get even worse, because the two sheriffs decide, even though they know Joanne is most likely in the car, they're just going to open fire on the vehicle.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. One of the sheriffs pulls out a shotgun and he shoots the Dodge in the front grill where the radiator is, and then also in one of the tires. The other sheriff pulls out his pistol. He pretty much shoots the vehicle in similar locations and unloads his pistol. Joanne, in the car, hears the officers firing on the vehicle, and she dives down into the floorboards, and thankfully, she was safe and miraculously not hurt and was not hit.
Oh, man, Joanne, tuck and roll, man. Get out of that car. Wow, I cannot believe that they just started shooting at a car that they're pretty sure that this girl is in.
They're in front of her mom's house.
Oh, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, there was a lot of luck involved in this part of the shootout, and a lot of people don't cover this part of the story, which I think is a crazy part of the story. Like, yeah. You never hear that there's a shootout that's involved with Kenneth Allen McDuff. Joanne actually does do what you're talking about. She gets the crap out of the car and just takes off as soon as she can and is safe. Kenneth, on the other hand, tries to floor the vehicle, and it doesn't go very far, and he bails out on foot and just takes off through the neighborhood. He actually makes it on foot to a local restaurant nearby, where he sees Joanne's brother in another vehicle. He just happens to be there eating with some friends. And Kenneth jumps in the car and says, "Take me to the constable's office. There's people who are shooting at me, and I don't know who they are." Later on, Kenneth would say that he did, in fact, see the sheriffs, and he knew that it was the police. And that didn't help his defense later in court. But, you know, he's trying to lie and come up with some reason to get me the heck out of here. So luckily, there was a third officer that was just down the street in another car that was able to swoop up and pick up the sheriffs and start heading in the direction where Kenneth had taken off on foot. They actually see Kenneth in the car with Joanne's brother, and they're able to sling into the parking lot, pull guns, and get both of the boys to jump out of the vehicle and put their hands up. So thus, Kenneth Allen McDuff is apprehended on August 9th, 1966. This is just 3 days after the events.
And that's the end of the story, right? Bye, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Well, that's what you would think, being
yeah,
that, you know.
That's what we would hope.
Yeah. Well, remember, he was on parole at this time for the 14 burglaries.
Yeah.
So he's not supposed to have a gun. He's not supposed to be doing anything criminal. And his parole is immediately revoked. And he's given, at the time, which was supposedly a large bond, it was $10,000. And he's thrown in jail to wait his trial. His brother Lonnie, however, was also apprehended. Do you remember Lonnie, rough, tough Lonnie McDuff from the beginning?
Yeah.
Well, he was supposedly Kenneth's best friend. And he was also known as Kenneth's muscle in his crew, that he would sic on people and stuff. Lonnie is charged with attempting to destroy evidence and hide the murder weapon because he took clothes that were used from both the boys in the vehicle and some of Louise's things and the murder weapon and tried to destroy them at their house. Police discovered that after they searched the house of the McDuffs.
That kind of almost only makes sense if Kenneth Allen McDuff had told his brother about the murders previously, right? Because he wouldn't have had time or the ability to call his brother up and say, "Hey, you need to destroy this evidence," before they get here with their warrant, which I'm sure they did right away.
And this is something that Gary Cartwright and Gary Laverne also get into in both of their publications about this case, is that there's a lot of people who believe that Lonnie had been covering up for Kenneth for a long time, for other cases, and it's not the first time that he's destroyed evidence and helped Kenneth get away with something.
Yeah. Well, that's also something that I wanted to mention, was this crime does not seem like something that somebody was doing their first time around.
Exactly.
You know, the fact that they approached three, even if they were kids, you know, these are teenagers, but they still approach three people. That's difficult to, you know, control three people when you're only two people and your accomplice is kind of half-assing the whole thing.
And your accomplice has never done anything like this whatsoever.
Yeah. And I mean, the viciousness and the brutality of what you told us just does not strike me as this is somebody's first time.
Yeah.
And even having an accomplice like that doesn't strike me as somebody's first time.
No, and the whole existence of Roy Dale Green in this case is super fascinating, because a lot of people seem to think that Kenneth Allen McDuff had him there specifically as an extra victim that he was kind of torturing in his own way, of seeing how far he could push Dale and seeing how much he could manipulate him and seeing if he could make him, if he could turn Dale into something close to what he is.
Yeah, it's definitely a power move.
Yeah,
I would say. And it's definitely something, not only are you forcing somebody to do this horrible thing with you, but then you also are getting validation because that person is complying with what you're wanting them to do.
Yep.
That being said, I have no sympathy for somebody who could go along with doing that. I'm absolutely glad that he did feel the guilt and he felt the need to step forward and to talk about what happened and everything. And I'm sure he did feel guilty. I'm sure that was a real response from him. But it doesn't forgive what he did. So mm-hmm. I hope that he got a stiff sentence, even after coming forward.
Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, one of the other things that Roy told authorities that became really important, which is actually how they caught Lonnie, was that Roy told them about how Kenneth made him help clean up the crime scene and how they took the boys' clothes, their extra clothes that they had for staying the night over, and used them to wipe the fingerprints off the car. And they used twigs and branches to brush away the tire tracks on the side of the road of their vehicle. Things like that.
Yeah, and that's just not something, somebody who, especially for a first kill type situation, they're going to be nervous, they're going to be jittery, they're going to be on edge. They're not going to, I would be very surprised to find somebody who is carefully cleaning the scene after murdering and brutalizing three people. The thing about the trunk is weird, about kind of putting the boys' bodies in the trunk, but then not really positioning correctly to close the
trunk.
Yeah, close the actual trunk up. So you could say that maybe that was the mark of somebody being sloppy, as in, you know, an example of how this could be somebody's first offense. But it could also be like, he knew that the car was going to be found. He at least, you know, put it to where the boys wouldn't be seen by the road or whatever.
Yep.
And, you know, focused his attention and his time on doing the little things that he would make sure he wouldn't be caught.
Yeah. And he moved to a new location. They moved completely away from where the boys' crime scene was to a more secluded road out in the middle of a field where he could have all the time in the world to do what he wanted to do. So, yeah, the movements, the cleaning up of the crime scene, the addition of Dale being there, all those things lead investigators to believe that he has, in fact, done similar crimes before this point. In fact, after that night of the 6th, Roy Dale says that he put new value and credence into all of the stories that he had originally written off from Kenneth as just fibs or, you know, tall tales, and he took them as truth about all of his previous murdering of women and raping women, and he was terrified.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that absolutely wasn't his first murder. At the very least, his first rape, you know?
Yeah. So now let's get into what actually happened to Kenneth Allen McDuff. His trial starts. You know, this is where the infamous pictures of him with his dark black slick back hair. There's another infamous picture of him standing with the jailers and the bailiffs, and he's just towering over them. He's 6'4" again, and he's pretty freaking creepy. Well, he takes the stand in his own defense, and he claims everything was Roy Dale Green's doing, blames everything on Roy. His attitude was one of like nonchalance, you know, he could care less about the fate of these three children, and he just didn't care. And it infuriated the jury. It infuriated everyone in the courtroom.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And it was, everyone just said that his eyes were cold and hollow and that he was soulless.
Wow. I'm surprised his defense team even allowed him. If he can't even pretend to have emotion for the victims, I'm surprised that they even let him testify. Well, I mean, obviously it's his choice ultimately, but I'm.
You know. He insisted.
Wow.
Yeah. And so Roy.
So he thought he was that good of a liar pretender.
Exactly.
Everybody was just going to believe everything, every word he had to say, huh?
Yep. His ego had gotten so big that he thought he was going to be able to charisma his way out of this one, too.
Yeah.
And Roy Dale takes the stand as the prime witness for the victims and the prosecution. And he tells everything. His details make sense about the crime. They match the forensics that were able to be found at the crime scene. And it's a very pretty much open and shut case. The jury takes very little time. In November of 1966, the jury finds Kenneth Allen McDuff guilty on 3 counts of murder, 1 count of rape, and he's sentenced to death via the infamous Texas electric chair. This is where Kenneth Allen McDuff would first get his moniker, the Broomstick Killer. For his part in the crimes, Roy Dale Green ended up serving 13 years of a 31-year sentence before being paroled. And also consider that's a pretty long time in the current climate of the late 60s and the early 70s, where people are getting paroled left and right out of prison, and we're going to get into that here in this next section.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm actually surprised he served that long, especially considering I would imagine he would have gotten a plea deal out of, you know, testifying and everything, and the fact that he came forward and was the star witness and all of that. So,
yeah, well, he did avoid the electric chair.
True.
Yep.
Well, I mean, so did other people. Well,
let's get into that. More of Ken Anderson's book, Crime in Texas, The Complete Guide to the Criminal Justice System. Part of the reason why this book was written was because of this case, and it takes up a whole huge section of the book. So in this book, it discusses what happened after Kenneth Allen McDuff was convicted. After the first 6 years on death row, Kenneth Allen McDuff had successfully appealed several times and actually won 2 separate stays of execution. So he was right about to get strapped in and everybody was ready for justice, and he just slips through the cracks, right? Well, then in 1972, something unprecedented happened across the country. The United States Supreme Court overturned the death penalty nationwide. And in 1974, they actually enacted a new constitutional death penalty law. But this one, of course, meant that every prisoner that was still on death row who had been originally sent to die via the death penalty now had their prison sentence commuted to life. And this included Kenneth Allen McDuff and 87 other Texas inmates who were currently on death row at the time. So what does this mean? This actually means that in a weird world, Kenneth Allen McDuff was now technically eligible for parole in 1976.
So why wouldn't you commute them to life without parole? Why would it be an automatic parole thing?
Well, so here's the thing. Most people thought this was terrible, right? So lots of people got really upset. And they're like, what about people like Kenneth Allen McDuff? Like, they never need to have a chance at parole. And everybody thought, you know, the parole board's going to be honest and they're going to see that. And someone like him's never going to get paroled.
Yeah.
They all were just like, okay, that's fine. He's just going to serve life. He'll rot in prison.
Yeah.
He's never going to get
paroled. Yeah, it's one of those things kind of like head in the sky, kind of like this sounds good on paper, where we're actually going to be giving people the chance to be released. And that's good. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing in general, but that only is predicated on the fact that people do their jobs and that parole boards actually thoroughly research the prisoners that, you know, are before them, which I'm going to assume didn't happen in this case.
Well, Jay, like the hair grease that he was so fond of putting on his head, he slipped into yet some more cracks, like a greasy pool of nastiness. He's just looking for a new crack to wiggle his way into. And that's what happened. So just after this, he makes several failed attempts to apply for parole again under the new standards. He starts getting frustrated, and in 1982, he actually is found guilty of attempted bribery of a parole official on the Texas Parole Board. He tried to offer them $10,000 to help him gain parole, and it almost worked, but it was caught and discovered in the middle of it. So,
oh my God, are you kidding me? First of all, how does he have $10,000 is question one. Second of all, so it's not even like the guy turned him in. It's that somebody else found this out.
Mm-hmm.
So $10,000 could, what kind of person can be bribed with $10,000 to try to get a triple murderer to walk free?
Well, we're going to talk about those kind of people that sit on the Texas parole board.
I'm so mad.
He gets tacked on with another bribery charge. He actually gets convicted of bribery while still in prison for life. That gets thrown into his record. And then during the 80s, of course, you talked about this, Aaron, crime in Texas skyrocketed. Texas lawmakers just, they didn't know what to do because they're still elected officials, right? And they're still trying to pass legislation to be tough on crime and to get reelected to their county seat, right? Well, that's all well and good, except for where the heck are you going to put all these prisoners now that have done these horrible crimes, especially when you don't manage to pass any legislation to fund building new infrastructure to house these prisoners who are just receiving longer and longer sentences.
Mm-hmm.
In 1987, a federal court found that this was a problem. They actually smacked Texas with more rulings. They came down and said that they found the Texas prison system was suffering so badly from overcrowding that it violated the inmates' civil rights itself.
Wow.
So they step in, they put down new limits that begin hitting prisons all over the state. They start changing prison populations, prison cell sizes, rec room sizes, commissary sizes, all kinds of things that Texas was just not prepared to deal with. It sets the Texas prison system back 2 decades in adjustment of infrastructure on how they were going to deal with their current prison populations. So this started having a cascade effect, which I think you mentioned in your episode, Aaron, where you start pushing prisoners out of Big Max facilities into lesser facilities where you can house them. And those prisoners are now taking up room that should be lesser known criminals who are now getting stuck into county jails that aren't even making it to the prison themselves, right? And it's just this top down problem where it's like, we don't have anywhere to put any of these people. So we keep putting them in crappier and crappier places, spreading them around, everything spread thin. What they're basically trying to do is just move everybody around to accommodate these new strict federal standards. The problem quickly becomes obvious to the governor, Bill Clements. Very discreetly and out of the eyes of the media, a pact was formed between the governor and the Texas Parole Board. This pact would attempt to alleviate prison overcrowding by releasing 150 inmates per day.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, state officials began handing out generous good time credits. They started paroling many inmates before they even reached prison. At the system's worst, inmates were serving 22 days for each year of their sentence. Parole rates topped out at a national all-time high of 80%. You ended up with a system where inmates would get out on parole, they'd commit more crimes, they'd go back into the system, which in turn pushed other criminals back out on parole for needed space. It was an awful, ineffective, vicious cycle that Texas was doomed to repeat over and over, just worsening the situation every time they paroled an inmate. Lesser criminals were obviously priority on the list to be paroled first, but after every day releasing 150 inmates...
Yeah, eventually you're going to get to the bad ones.
Exactly. So you can see that once you start doing this, after about a month, you start running out of car thieves, drug users, scam artists. You start moving into people who've done assault, people who've committed fraud, kidnapping, and yes, even rapists and murderers. So on October of 1989, for some reason, the Texas Parole Board reached the name of Kenneth Allen McDuff. In a very short hearing with very minimal analysis of his files, his record, which showed 16 felony convictions, 14 burglaries, 3 murders, 1 rape, and a bribery conviction, somehow the Texas Parole Board looked past it all and gave him the big green stamp of approval for parole.
Do we know anything more about the people who were on that parole board or what happened? Was it simply just an oversight?
Yeah, I think it was. I think because...
So they basically just didn't even look at his file.
That's what a lot of people have said.
He was just presented to them and they said, okay, bye.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people have said. Because if you think about it, if you have to parole 150 people a day, how are you going to read giant files like that?
Yeah, it's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, we do it, and it takes weeks to read people's criminal files and go through all their court hearing documents and everything that everybody's ever said, that note from the principal from his high school. They probably didn't read that.
Yeah, but I mean, and that's completely understandable, but at the same time, don't you just have to look over the one sheet that lists his convictions? I mean, as soon as you get down to rape and murder, throw him back in the prison, let's move on to the next guy. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's that difficult to make sure that you're keeping the bad ones where they need to be.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of the blame falls on the Texas prison board itself.
Yeah, and I hope that every single one of those people who ended up agreeing to parole him never slept a wink for the rest of their lives, because what happens next is absolutely blood on their hands.
Yeah. And you know,
it is
the details that I described earlier, which again, I did that for a reason. Those were dictated in court notes.
Yep.
From Roy Dale Green's testimony.
And they should have read and should have known this person is a monster who should not be allowed to be around the rest of us.
Yeah. They should have read Roy Dale Green's testimony and went exactly what you said. Like, we cannot allow this.
Yeah.
But now he's out. He's a free man, Aaron. And what's crazy? Law enforcement, officers, prosecutors, judges, normal citizens alike, they're all floored. They're flabbergasted. They're terrified at this decision. Residents in and around Rosebud, Texas, actually hear that Kenneth Allen McDuff is planning to return home. They bar their windows. They bought large dogs. They even purchased weapons. More first-time gun owners were registered in the six counties surrounding that area that year than ever in state history. So pretty much everybody heard Kenneth Allen McDuff was coming back to a county near them, and everyone ran out and just got registered and bought a gun.
Yeah, and we see this happen a lot. You know, community reactions to crimes that are happening. In this case, man, it would have been great if one of those people ended up shooting him in the head as soon as he walked out of prison.
Or if they'd all just gotten together.
And again, I know some of the listeners are going to be like, wow, Aaron and Shay are very angry this episode. And if you don't know about this guy, you're going to find out why we're so outraged.
Yeah. Wait till the next part.
Everyone should be outraged, because this dude wasn't a person. This dude wasn't human. He's not like the rest of us. He's a monster who should have been in prison for his entire life.
Yeah. He's someone akin to like a BTK. You know, a sexual sadist like Robert Ben Rhodes, who we just allowed to walk, or the Golden State Killer,
you know,
who we had in our hands and we allowed them to walk out the front door.
Yeah.
We're talking about a full blown Texas prison system that had finally collapsed, failed, set itself on fire, and everyone knew it too. Texans were waiting for Kenneth Allen McDuff to strike again. And next episode, we're going to get into not the if, but the when.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that was the end of your episode. I was ready to rage on with you. Wow.
Well, we got plenty of space in next episode to rage on, and there's a lot of other things that are going to be infuriating.
I know.
Yeah, it's a crazy freaking case, and he's one of the most notorious killers in Texas state history, and for a reason.
Yeah.
And I just felt like we had to do this case. I felt like it needed to be done because a few other podcasts have done it. They just haven't done it in as much depth as we're going to do it in. And I feel like you need to tell this whole story to really understand why this case is so freaking important.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only for the victims, but also just in general of the criminal justice system, of asking these questions about why and how did this happen?
Yep.
And how can we move forward to make sure something like this never happens again? Because we hear these stories all the time of people who are violent criminals who do bad things to people who then get paroled and be released back to live amongst the rest of us. And then they continue hurting people. And it's just, it's unacceptable, like we said.
Yeah. So sexual sadists who have antisocial personality disorder should never be let back out.
No. And I mean, as far as I know, I took criminal psychology classes 10 years ago or so. But from what I know and what I was always taught is that people like that, there's been no evidence to show that they can be rehabilitated, meaning they're going to continue to do these things forever. If they have an opportunity to hurt someone, to rape, to murder, whatever, that's what they're going to do because they're broken. Yeah. And
you can see how hard he's trying to get out. Like, every inch that we give him when he was in prison, he took it and he found a new way to manipulate it and trying to get himself to eventually be free, to do what he wants to do again.
Yeah. Even if he didn't do anything for the rest of his life, you know what I mean? It still wouldn't be acceptable.
No.
But we know that that's not the case.
Yeah, and for all that...
We know that there's more horrible things to come. And it fills me with such, like, impotent rage right now. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners are feeling that way. And I'm really sorry you guys have to live with it until next week where you find out the rest of the story.
It's not been fun to research, I can tell you that. Oh,
I know. I feel bad for you. It was hard to listen to. To be honest, with everyone out there, actually, after the description of the murders, we actually had to take a break and pick up and re-record tonight. We started last night just because it was...
We needed a mental health.
It was hard. Yeah, it was hard. We had to kind of like hug and
We went and pet reset. The dogs for like an hour so we could actually go to bed.
Yeah. And it's just, that's what happens when you research this stuff so intensely and you had to write it all and you've been stewing in this for so long. And
well, and it kind of pisses me off too when like people make fun of his name and they're like, oh, the broomstick killer, like that's a stupid name for a serial killer, he just choked someone with a broomstick. And it's like, no, there's other reasons why that's his name, and he's freaking terrifying. What he did is deplorable, and like, again, that's why you need to know the full story, you know.
Ugh, woof.
Yeah, well, for part two, you're going to have to wait till next week. But until then, I feel like we need some more mental health moments.
Yeah, until then, pet your dogs and your cats
and
your hedgehogs and whatever you got. Call your friends. Tell them you love them.
Yeah.
Go get a pedicure. Whatever you need to do. But in the meantime, for now... What we've got for you is some good news.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Well, I've got a very sweet little story from you. This one is coming from Houston. This is actually, I believe, from Pearland, which we've mentioned Pearland a few times. I mentioned it in the Texas 7 episode, and I think we've had a couple good stories coming out of Pearland. So good things are happening in Pearland.
I'm imagining there's just pears everywhere.
No, actually, so when I was doing my research on the Texas 7 case, that is absolutely correct.
Really?
The reason why Pearland got its name is because they have abundance of pear trees.
Wow.
Yes.
I don't really like pears. But hey, I know a lot of people do, and they're excited about Pearland.
Well, this is the story of Lane Rex. He is a 6-year-old little boy. When he was 4 years old, he was actually diagnosed with leukemia.
Oh.
So he's been going through chemotherapy treatments. And a few weeks ago, this story was just dropped sort of right at the end of April. A few weeks ago, he actually fractured one of his vertebrae.
Oh.
Now, this kid is super active, especially for a kid, you know, who's going through leukemia and going through so much hardship with his medical condition. But he loves baseball. He's baseball fan, and he actually plays on a little leagues team, and he loves to like run around and do the slides and everything. And so this back brace that he had to wear because of his fractured vertebrae was really upsetting to him. He couldn't really play in the baseball games, and he was actually also afraid that his, you know, the other students at his school were going to make fun of him.
Yeah.
Because it was like, you know, one of those big, stiff back braces that he has to wear. He can't move very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was a little upset about it, and his mother said, I was concerned that it might break his spirit.
Aww.
Yeah. So obviously everybody was concerned about this poor kid who has leukemia, and now he has to wear this back brace. And so his mom wanted to do something a little bit special for him to see if she can make the back brace a little bit better for this poor kid. What she did is she went to a company called ADDI Printing. This is a company that specializes in vinyl wraps, like wraps for cars or large banner signs and everything.
Yeah.
She went to the company and she explained the situation, and she said, I know that this is something a little bit unusual for your company, but is there any way you can make a wrap specialized for my son's back brace? And they said, absolutely, we can do that. And in fact, we're not going to charge you.
Wow.
So what they did is they made a graphic wrap for his back brace, and they made it into a jersey of his favorite Astros player, who is Jose Altuve, the second baseman for the Houston Astros, and also the shortest player in Major League Baseball.
Oh.
Which I only knew because I had to do a little Googling on Jose Altuve because I don't know anything about baseball. He loves Jose Altuve. Like I said, huge baseball fan, little six-year-old kid.
That's awesome.
And so they made this really cool graphic wrap for his back brace that looks exactly like Jose Altuve's jersey.
That's great for Lane. And he's got a great name. Lane Rex. Man. That's an awesome name.
It's a pretty cool baseball name, isn't
it? Yeah.
And so he can wear this thing with pride. He doesn't feel embarrassed by it or uneasy about it. He feels really proud wearing his back brace. They hope that his cancer treatments are going to be over by December. And so he's going to be through with his leukemia treatments by then. And hopefully his back brace, his vertebrae is going to be corrected here pretty soon, and so he won't have to wear this back brace for too much longer. And this whole news story came out not too long ago. It was just a few days ago. But I can only imagine with all of the community outreach that the Houston Astros do, I can imagine he's going to get maybe a signature, a meet and greet with Jose Altuve. Now, I don't know this for sure, but I'm imagining that's probably what's going to happen because the Houston Astros, I think we've even talked about them on the show before in one of our prior good news segments. They're usually very good about, you know, doing stuff like this.
Definitely.
And so I think that's a really cute story of a community coming together again and a little shop doing something for free.
Yeah,
something
super
that's
cool.
Completely out of the ordinary for them, but, you know, giving this little kid a little happiness in his life.
Yeah, it's crazy how so many good news stories come out of Houston.
I know, and Houston, you know, Houstonites, guys, you guys come for us. I don't know why.
Yeah. And you come for us and you always suspect that we're Dallasites.
We are not from Dallas.
We are not.
In fact, we probably have a few reviews that we're going to read that are that case. Houston, a lot of good news stories come from your town.
Yeah, we really like you.
Yeah.
Don't hate on us. We're not from Dallas. Hey, Dallas people, you're fine too. Everybody's fine here.
Everybody get along. After the horrible story that we just read, we just need to all get along.
Southern hospitality, right?
That's right.
Yeah, let's all share a pitcher of Shiner or maybe some margaritas. And, you know, we'll listen to some nice Texas country music. Now you know that it's time to move on to the next segment.
Yeah. And you guys know every week we talk about this. If you give us a 5-star review on either iTunes or on our Facebook page, which you can find if you just search for All Crime, No Cattle, we will read your review on air. And it's great. And we love it.
Yeah.
You can also find us online. We are on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. We are on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. And you can shoot us an email at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. We love to hear from you guys. And before we begin our reviews, we also want to mention again our merch shop. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten our merch yet. We have one of our fellow Texas podcasters from Lone Star Lawn Disorder recently ordered a t-shirt. She got it in. She really likes it. We haven't gotten ours yet, but we're excited about it. So we will definitely give you a little bit of a review when those come in. We're going to be wearing those babies with pride. So if you go to our merch shop at allcrimenocattle.threadless.com, there's a ton of different stuff that you can get there.
Yeah, you get that sweet bone and rose logo that everybody likes.
Yeah, it looks really cool, and we hope you guys check that out. And remember, between now and May 7th, I believe, you can get free shipping on all orders over $45.
Yeah, and I think it's for international listeners. I think it might be $80, so our friends in South Africa and Australia, Get with your other friends, make a group purchase, get you some free shipping.
There you go.
So let's pick things up. We haven't done Facebook reviews in a while, Aaron. Let's get some of those going. Our first one comes from Share Rules. Indeed you do, because you left us a 5-star review. One of my favorite podcasts. I've lived in Fort Worth, Texas my whole life. I love hearing about these local crimes. I'd love to hear you guys do a show on Fort Worth's missing trio. Love ya.
Interesting. So we've considered actually covering that case.
It's a big one.
It's a big one. There are also, from what I understand, there's some problems with covering that case that I don't really want to get into on the podcast. If it seems like maybe that's something that we can do in the future, definitely we would think about it. But Yeah, there's actually a reason why we've kind of avoided it, to be quite honest with you guys.
Yeah, but thank you, Cher.
But yeah, thank you for the suggestion. It is a very sad case. If you're interested at all, please go research that. It's very sad, very interesting, and one right here from Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm. Here's another nice, short, sweet review from Kara Shaw, like Detective Shaw.
Oh.
So yeah, I love your name. She leaves 5 stars. Alexa Shuey says, 5 stars. I love this podcast. I look forward to listening to it every week. Shay and Aaron make my workday fly by and do a fantastic job on every episode. P.S. Thank you for letting me know a murder happened 5 minutes away from my house in Saginaw. It made my day? Question mark.
We get you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get excited and then you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
Well, if you're listening to this, you know one happened in my hometown.
Yep. Well, 3, technically.
Well, yeah, 3, yeah.
Yeah.
But a case. Denny Bollock says, 5 stars. Excellent crime podcast. I found many crime podcasts on Spotify, but until stumbling onto this gold mine, I had not found a podcast that focuses on specifically my home state of Texas. Keep doing what you're doing, Aaron and Shay. They also spelled my name right. One of the few that spelled my name right. And they mentioned the K-9 crime unit. They're, ooh, yeah, there you go, guys. They're freaking asleep. They're dreaming about solving crimes.
Wait, what did they say about the crime unit?
Oh, they said, keep doing what you're doing, Aaron, Shay, and the K-9 crime unit.
Oh. Yeah.
I would love to hear a miniseries over the Texas killing fields. If you haven't already, check out Catherine Casey's book, Deliver Us. Yeah, that's one of the ones that's been requested before.
Yeah.
We're still considering it. It's, again, those complicated big ones we really have to plan out. And we've been doing a lot of big cases. We just talked about this. We're going to try.
Oh, Lordy. Yes, we have.
For
we've
our
been
own,
really killing ourselves yeah, on it.
For our own
I'm
mental
sure
sanity.
Yeah.
And for the longevity of the show, we're going to spread some of these big, bad cases out over, hopefully, some time.
Yeah. Thank you for the review. The dogs are right now being lazy, but they were being incredibly annoying
oh
earlier.
Oh my god, we had to stop like 5 times.
Jeez.
They were investigating the room for clues.
Ugh.
I'll do one more, okay?
Okay.
The last one we're going to do today comes from Talitha Prospert. It's 5 stars. One of my new favorite podcasts. I love the dad/corny jokes from Shea Butter. And Aaron's little side comments are always exactly what I was thinking at that time. Doesn't hurt that the chemistry is awesome. Love y'all. Keep it up. So I think those are all
oh,
really
that's
good.
Very nice. Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you guys so much. And now we can switch over to iTunes. Our first one is from Kevin Rager. He says, this is a great podcast. So far, I'm loving this podcast. The stories are interesting. The podcast doesn't have commercials, parentheses, yet. I am sure that they will have in the future. They don't blab too long before getting to the meat and potatoes. Keep the episodes coming. Thank you
well,
so much, Kevin.
Just hypothetically speaking, if there are ever commercials coming in the future, there's probably going to be a Patreon associated with it, and it'll probably be very affordable to have commercial-free listening. Just throwing that out into the ether, you know? If you think it, it might happen. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. And hey, guys, just for the future, you can skip right over commercials. I do it.
Yeah.
Every episode, every podcast. Who listens to commercials? Just skip them. You got that button that says skip forward 30 seconds.
Yeah. If your podcatching device doesn't have a skip button, you're doing it wrong.
Exactly. The next one comes from LBMB5763, and they say, gotta love Texas crime stories. Tons of fascinating cases in the Lone Star State, and these two are doing a good job covering them, even if they come at it with a bit of Dallas bias at times. Go Astros!
There it is. There it is.
That's one of the ones I was thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, guys, we're not from Dallas.
Yeah, we're from Funky Town, Fort Worth.
I feel like we need to start the show now. I'm Aaron. That's Shay. We're not from Dallas.
Yeah.
We don't live in Dallas.
We don't hate Houston.
Dallas is fine. I love Dallas. I love hanging out in Dallas, but driving there, parking is a freaking nightmare. We know that because we've spent the last 2 weekends in Dallas. It's been a nightmare. I hate driving to Deep Ellum. I hate parking in Deep Ellum. It's the worst.
But,
and we don't ever say bad things about Houston. You guys, you guys got thin skin, man. You got thickening that skin up. Use some sugar scrub.
We're tough cowboys and cowgirls from Cowtown, USA, Fort Worth, Texas. We're like, sometimes it could be an hour and a half to get to Dallas from where we live.
Good
you know
God.
How far that is? Distance-wise, in miles, that's a long way away from Dallas.
Anyways, thank you, LBMB5763. We appreciate you. And here's some Houston love. Oh, I'm thumping my chest. Okay.
God.
Our next one comes from Courtney1000, and she says, newbie, just found y'all and can't wait. I like that this episode is an hour. I hate when they're only 30 minutes. Well, you know, you've been getting more than an hour here lately, because the cases we've been doing have been so big.
In for a dollar, in for a pound. We don't do little half-butt podcasts.
Yeah, no, you know, and those are fine.
I listen to some.
Yeah, you need a little sprinkling. Usually, though, we try to do pretty research heavy. And so if you do that, there's just no way you can cover an entire case in half an hour.
No, you're not doing it justice.
I appreciate that you like our length. Hopefully the longer ones you also enjoy.
Boy, that's a real hot button issue in the podcasting listening community. It's like, I only want an episode that's less than 18 minutes and completely tells me everything I need to know about the Golden State Killer.
If it's longer than 44 minutes, I'm not going to listen. I'm going to give you a 1-star review.
Yeah.
Sorry, you guys were bitter.
Yeah, but you guys know what we're talking about. You're not here for a short case.
No, you guys are great. All right, so the next one, should this be our last one?
Yeah.
Okay, the next one comes from Kay Lizzle. From the Lone Star to the Green Mountain State. They say, I just recently moved to Vermont and have been missing Texas like crazy. This podcast is awesome and makes me feel closer to home. I'm from Laredo, Texas, on the border, and I would love to hear a story from there.
Ooh,
interesting.
I know somebody I work with from Laredo.
Oh, yeah?
And I should talk to them because they're a rangeland specialist, and I bet they know some people out there, like some sheriffs and such.
Oh, that would be cool. Yeah, but congrats moving to Vermont. I've heard it is beautiful. I've never been to Vermont.
I bet that's a big change from Laredo.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I bet it's. Yeah, but I've heard Vermont is absolutely beautiful.
I love.
Never been.
I love both areas.
Hey, Kay Lizzle, you know, if you got an extra bedroom to spare, you know, we'll come visit you.
Yeah, just put us up.
We'll bring the dogs. With that, I think this episode has reached its end.
All right. Well, you know what we do at the very end? We try and put you onto a podcast that Aaron and I have both been enjoying. And what podcast is that right now, Aaron? I put you onto it.
Yes, it's called People Are Wild. And this is a really cool, it's a complete departure from true crime. Mm-hmm. So if you're like, oh my God, I'm so tired of true crime, especially after this episode, I do not blame you. Go listen to this podcast. It's really cool. It's a single narrator. She is an emergency room nurse. Mm-hmm. And it's her entire podcast is about like weird medical stuff and like current news that involves
her term for it is medication.
Medication, yeah. And it's such a cool podcast. It's a single narrator, but she's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
She's really funny. Her episodes are all really interesting. They're kind of like a mishmash of kind of different topics, but topics that kind of go together for one theme in an episode. And she's also really hilarious on Twitter. I would definitely give her a follow.
She also does little contests at the end of her
episodes. Oh, yeah. And you won the last one. And it involved something made of glass in a
rectum. That's the technical term.
I was going to be delicate.
I got my medication. It's a rectum. But yeah, it was an episode all about what it's like to be struck by lightning.
And Shay's literally been talking about this episode for like a week since he listened to it.
Well, it was great up until today at my work. I was doing some stuff outside and a freak thunderstorm just swept in and there was just lightning everywhere. And all I could think about was this episode and what it would be like to be hit by lightning.
He actually texted me, oh my God, this is like that People Are Wild episode. So yeah, absolutely. Go listen to it. Like I said, it's really good. It's a little different.
You learn something.
Yeah, absolutely. I love science. And I love when you can inject humor and science and make it educational, but also fascinating and funny.
Yeah.
It's just the perfect thing. Definitely go check it out. People Are Wild podcast. And we're going to have her promo coming up.
I think it's time to saddle up and get on down the road.
No, I am taking a hammer to that thing. All right, guys.
Yeah. Round up the chuck wagon. We got our supplies.
You know, the episode is coming to an end when we lose our minds, because it seems to happen at the end of every episode, just with sheer glee that it's over and that we can move on for like a day until we have to research the next episode.
The great migration of tumbleweeds has begun, and we got to follow it on to the next West Texas town.
All right, guys. Well, you guys be good to yourselves.
Thanks for sticking around with us. And always remember, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.
This is Kim, your friendly neighborhood ER nurse. I'm the host of People Are Wild, the only podcast that claims to bring medical entertainment, medutainment, on a weekly basis. I can be found on your favorite podcast listening app, iTunes, and Google Play, and you could talk to me on Twitter at People Are Wild.